Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute today at lunchtime. We rarely have lunchtime functions at a weekend, but we've done one before and we're doing a second one today. So welcome to the Prime Minister on behalf of our Chairman Nick Johnson and our board members, some of whom are here today, the Sydney Institute staff. And I should especially welcome Maurice Payne, the Foreign Minister, and Nick Greiner, the President of the Liberal Party, for coming along tonight, and there are many others here. Scott Morrison, I think he gave his first speech here in 2010 when he was a frontbencher in opposition, and look where he is now. So he doesn't need an introduction, and I won't give him one, except to say, Prime Minister, that you're very welcome, as always, at the Sydney Institute, and we're delighted you're here on this occasion to talk on the general topic of international relations. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jared, and particularly to my ministerial colleague, Senator Payne. It's great to have her back straight off the plane from Myanmar, where she's been over the weekend, to Nick Greiner, and who's here as well. I see an old Treasury Secretary over there, John Fraser. Good to see you too, Fraser. Thank you all for coming together on a Saturday. And I want to particularly thank Jared and Anne for bringing the members of the Sydney Institute here together on a Saturday. And so I thank you for your attendance. What is most important to me as Prime Minister is that I seek to humbly do every day things that make Australia even stronger than we are today, both now and in the future. To protect what we already have as Australians and to do everything we can to ensure that we are stronger so Australians can realise their opportunities in the future. Keeping our economy strong through lower taxes, supporting small and medium-sized family businesses, building the infrastructure we need in our cities and our regions and all across our vast country, so I can guarantee the essential services that Australians rely on. That's what the strong economy's for, to guarantee those services: Medicare, hospitals, schools, affordable medicines, aged care, support for our veterans. That's why I'm so focused on achieving a stronger economy, because that's what realises those services. Keeping Australians safe, whether that's protecting our kids online from cyberbullying, keeping families safe from domestic violence, protecting Australians from the threat of terrorism, keeping our borders strong and the institutions and frameworks that keep our borders strong, or defending our values and our freedoms both here and around the world through our Australian Defence Forces. And keeping Australians together by ensuring we show respect for each other, for older Australians in residential aged care, removing needless and preventing needless conflict and provocation in our workplaces so employees and employers can work together for the good of their enterprise and themselves. Listening to young Australians in particular who want to ensure our environment is protected for the future and that we address climate change. And respecting migrants who came to Australia, whether recently or over many generations ago, because we were a successful multicultural society and because they believed we would respect religious freedoms. Even stronger, that's what I want Australia to be. And to protect Australia also from the things that would make us weaker: a weaker economy, weaker borders, weaker protections for our national security, weaker respect for the freedoms and the values that have made Australia the great country we are today. A stronger Australia will always stand up for what we believe in. And that's why I've come here to address you today. In my first major foreign policy speech in Australia as Prime Minister, I said that our foreign policy defines what we believe about the world and our place in it. Foreign policy must speak of our character and our values. What we stand for, what we believe in, and indeed, if need be, what we will defend. And I made this point. Those who see foreign relations and our relations through a narrow transactional lens sell Australia short. Australia is more than the sum of the deals we do. We're much bigger than that. We're a principled and pragmatic people, clear about our beliefs, yet realistic about the world that is around us. We pursue an ambitious agenda in the Indo-Pacific. We are a regional power with global interests. We have a responsibility to contribute to debates that shape our world. And the world does listen, and to do so in a constructive and innovative fashion, always seeking to focus on the problems we're trying to solve. So much of our prosperity and our security is dependent on the world beyond our borders. We've always been an outward-looking country. And it was almost 40 years ago that Prime Minister Fraser, in the context of debates about the Middle East, the Cold War and apartheid, explained why Australia should always participate in these debates. He gave three reasons. First, too many Australians have died in places remote from their home, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, for us to be unconcerned about the preservation of world peace. Their sacrifice not only confers a right, but imposes indeed a duty, he said, on Australia to speak on these issues. Secondly, Prime Minister Fraser said, the middle-ranking countries of the world should recognise they have a role to play. It would not only be foolish, he said, but a political and moral failing to assume that nations such as Australia should be seen but not heard on the great issues, as he described them. And third, in a Western world characterised by a great deal of self-doubt and division, remember he said this a long time ago, much has changed, and by a degree of disillusionment which has not yet been wholly overcome, every contribution to clarifying issues and strengthening resolve is valuable. Well, I agree. I agree with what Prime Minister Fraser said. In an age of renewed global uncertainty, Australia should seek to clarify issues and strengthen resolve based on the principles and the beliefs we hold dear. And to that end, I want to update you today on steps our government is taking, our Liberal National Government, to add clarity to our voice on some important issues consistent with our beliefs and our national interests. The first issue I want to address is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, as it is known, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. Struck in 2015, the JCPOA resulted from a decade of negotiation. It included the United States, China, France, Germany, Russia, the European Union and the UK, as well as Iran, as its signatories. Now, as we know, the United States withdrew from the agreement in May of this year. Criticisms were made of the agreement, including inadequate inspection and verification mechanisms and its narrow scope. Now, in response to this, on the 16th of October, I announced a without prejudice review of the JCPOA. We should take a look. We should assess these suggestions in light of the concerns raised with me about its effectiveness, including concerns raised here at home. I asked my department to lead a team of experts drawn from across government to examine these and other criticisms and potential weaknesses. The review team consulted widely with Australia's international partners in the US, Europe, Middle East, Asia, and with the International Atomic Energy Agency. I sought views from experts outside government. I also discussed the matter with a number of foreign leaders during the recent summit season. And the review team examined if the JCPOA is delivering what was intended. The conclusion from the review team is that, on balance, it is. And that's welcome news. Substantial restrictions on Iran's nuclear activity remain in place. The International Atomic Energy Agency has verified on 13 occasions that Iran's actions remain in keeping with the deal's limits. The deal took Iran from the brink of having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon to a place where the international community now has daily oversight of its nuclear activities. Now, these are worthy achievements. Iran is well placed to expand its enrichment capacity rapidly if the deal were to break down. So maintaining the support for the JCPOA serves our interests in nuclear non-proliferation and reinforcing the rules-based international system. It is consistent with Australia's position on other non-proliferation issues, for example, support for a negotiated deal on verifiable denuclearisation on the Korean Peninsula. And it serves our interests in encouraging rules-based approaches to resolving other issues of international concern, including the South China Sea. But as the deal was only ever designed to cover nuclear issues, it's not the full story, and that's where most of the frustration, I think, has been. Our concerns about Iran relate not to what's in the agreement, but what's not in the agreement. The agreement does not address Iran's destabilising activities in the Middle East and beyond. It does not address Iran's proliferation of ballistic missiles and technology, and activities undermining Israel's security and support for terrorist groups. These activities are ones the global community must act on. So today I'm announcing that Australia will add to our already substantial support for international efforts, particularly in relation to Iran's ballistic missile proliferation and Iran's support for destabilising activity. Australia continues to apply sanctions required under UNSC Resolution 2231 on nuclear and ballistic missile-related materials. And we will also continue to apply autonomous sanctions on the export of arms and related materials. Working with our partners and consistent with our obligations under the UN Security Council resolutions, Australia will work to tighten the net on Iran's missile proliferation networks and support for activities that are destabilising the region. We will keep the option of additional autonomous sanctions under active review. In the Financial Action Task Force, an international body tasked with combating counter-terrorism financing, we will support the imposition of countermeasures if Iran does not meet its commitments to address its anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing deficiencies. Now, turning to broader Middle East issues, I have been also concerned for some time about the ratcheting up of rhetoric and action aimed at isolating Israel. We regard the biased and unfair targeting of Israel and the UN General Assembly in particular as deeply unhelpful to efforts to build peace and stability. The UN General Assembly is now the place where Israel is bullied and where anti-Semitism is cloaked in the language about human rights. It is where Israel is regularly accused of what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks called the five cardinal sins against human rights: racism, apartheid, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and attempted genocide. Think about it. A nation of immigrants, with a free press, parliamentary democracy, financially prosperous, the source of tremendous innovation in the world, and a refuge from persecution and genocide, is somehow now the centre of cruelty in the world. It's ridiculous. It's intellectual fraud. To the point that we seem to be heading closer now to the dispiriting decade of the 70s when it comes to ritualistic denunciations of Israel, compromised and hypocritical global processes, a capacity to look the other way when it comes to terrorist organisations, and widespread fatigue in Western societies about the lack of progress. Last year, there were 17 UN General Assembly resolutions critical of Israel. This compared with a total of 5. For all other countries, Myanmar, Syrian Arab Republic, Russia's actions in Crimea and Ukraine, Iran and North Korea, but 17 in relation to Israel. This year, the Human Rights Council passed 6 motions condemning Israel, compared to a total of 14 across the rest of the world. And last month, at my direction, Australia opposed 6 resolutions that attacked Israel in the UN General Assembly. These included the Jerusalem resolution, which contains biased and one-sided language attacking Israel and denies its historical connection to the city, and the peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine resolution, which confers on the Palestinian Authority a status it does not have. In the past, we had abstained on these resolutions. not anymore, and not on my watch. The standard you walk past is the standard you accept. We all know that principle. We won't turn a blind eye to an anti-Semitic agenda masquerading as the defence of human rights as a nation like Australia. Last week, Australia supported a UN General Assembly resolution to condemn the egregious and ongoing violent acts of the terrorist organisation Hamas. Hamas are violent extremists, terrorists who use the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as an excuse to inflict terror. They should have no friends at the UN. The failure of the resolution to pass with the requisite majority was appalling. Australia condemns Hamas's activities in the strongest possible terms. Why others failed to do so is evidence of the stalemate that has been reached, where sticking with your side is blind to denouncing terrorism. It's how bad it's got. Now, that is not to say we are not ever critical of Israel. Indeed, we will, if need be, openly rebuke a sincere friend, because friends speak to each other sincerely and freely. The Australian government has expressed our strong concern over Israel's land appropriations, demolitions and settlement activity. I indeed have done that directly, Prime Minister to Prime Minister. The settlements undermine peace and contribute to the stalemate we now see. But we make the point, the international community must move beyond ritual denunciations of Israel to urge a return to negotiations towards a two-state solution. If anything, the ritual denunciations are getting in the way of progress. Australia's national interests are well served by our productive and increasingly diverse relationship with Israel. Australia has always been one of Israel's greatest friends, and I intend for that to remain the case. This is underpinned by our nation's shared values, including our commitment to democracy and the rule of law. Australia also benefits from a vigorous, creative Jewish community here in Australia, who most recently welcomed, not that long ago, with all Australians, Prime Minister Netanyahu on his visit to Australia in February of 2017, the first by a serving Israeli Prime Minister. Modern Israel is a vibrant multicultural democracy with a strong economy and world-leading industrial science and research capabilities. Despite having the most powerful military in the region, Israelis, as we know, live each day under existential threat. Since 1948, Israel has fought numerous wars with their neighbours and thousands of skirmishes, which are a constant reminder of the daily threats they face. My own visit to Israel many years ago and my interactions since have confirmed to me the future is not something Israelis take for granted. It's not something they can take for granted. We should not also allow ourselves the indulgence of thinking otherwise about our great friend. We should understand what they live with every day. Over the past 2 years alone, Australia and Israel have expanded cooperation in defence industry and aviation security. It remains in our national interest to see Israel succeed as a liberal participatory democracy in the Middle East. And we regard it as imperative that Australia continues to strongly support its right to exist within secure and internationally recognised borders. So this brings me finally to the Middle East process itself, and including the status of Jerusalem. Australia has a deep interest in seeing the emergence of a successful two-state solution, not just as a country seeking to strengthen, resolve and clarify issues, but because of our history as well. Last year, Australia commemorated the centenary of the Battle of Beersheba, a battle that is a proud part of Australia's history. We proudly recall that it was Australia that chaired the committee that recommended to the UN General Assembly the creation of the State of Israel, and then voted in favour of the petition of mandate for Palestine. We're also proud to have been the first nation state to vote to do so, and when we did so, because after the horrors of World War II, we wanted a refuge from man's inhumanity to man. We've turned up, we've played our part, we've done our share, and we've paid the price through great sacrifice. That's what gives us a microphone on this topic. As a practical demonstration of our ongoing commitment to peace in the Middle East, Australia has had military observers with the UN's Truce Supervision Organisation since 1956, Our contribution to the UNTSO forms the fifth largest contingent of the entire operation and represents Australia's longest commitment to any operation. We continue to make substantial contributions to security and stability in the Middle East because it's in our interests to do so. Around 1,200 ADF personnel in the Middle East are promoting regional security, including as part of the Global Anti-Daesh Coalition, at the request of the Iraqi government, training Iraqi security forces. An Australian frigate patrols in the Gulf of Bab al-Mandab in the Straits in support of regional security and freedom of navigation as part of a multinational naval force. An Australian commands the multinational force and observers in the Sinai overseeing the Camp David peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And we've made a difference to thousands of refugees in the region through our humanitarian contribution of over $600 million to Syrian and Iraqi refugees since 2011. And we continue donations to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East of some $41 million 2017-19. In short, our credentials as a force for security and stability in the Middle East are beyond question. Our commitment to supporting peace in the Middle East and for Israel to peacefully exist within secure and internationally recognised borders has always been accompanied by our commitment to the two-state solution. The UN Security Council has consistently endorsed a two-state solution, negotiated directly between the Israelis and Palestinians, as the way in which final status issues are to be resolved. These final status issues include the status of Jerusalem, the right of return of refugees, the status of Israeli settlements, the provision of security, and the future borders of a Palestinian state. Now, successive UN Security Council resolutions have laid down expectations of UN member states on a range of related issues. And since the Oslo Accords of the 1990s, public support for a two-state solution has now diminished inside both Israel and in the Palestinian territories. Today, neither Israel nor the Palestinians view the other side really as a genuine partner for peace. Though a two-state solution remains the only viable way to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, the obstacles, we must admit, to achieving such a solution are becoming insurmountable. We hope not. The lapse of time and the failure to progress the negotiations, I believe, has changed this Israeli-Palestinian situation in recent times. A rancid stalemate has emerged. Slavish adherence to the conventional wisdom over decades appears only to be further entrenching the stalemate, providing a leave pass for continued action, for everyone just to keep doing what they were doing and looking the other way. Don't raise the issue, just keep doing what you're doing. Pious assertions about a commitment to a two-state solution strain credibility if we're not prepared to question the conventional wisdom about how we believe this goal will actually be achieved. Expecting a different outcome while continuing to do the same old thing is not the way, as particularly my cabinet colleagues know, that's not the way I deal with problems. It's not the way our government deals with problems. So, Australia acknowledges that Jerusalem's ultimate status, including its borders and boundaries, is a final status issue to be resolved between the parties. That's uncontested. We also know that as those issues are debated, they are hotly contested in terms of their detail. And there are a range of strong views on these issues around the world. We acknowledge there are other views, and we remain committed to engaging positively with all of our partners and neighbours who have different views on this topic. That's okay. And we're confident that others will respect the views that we ourselves form when we do so in a respectful and in an honest way. Fundamentally, it's the right of every country to determine its national capital. That is why the government I lead asked the question. He's asked the question about the position we have long adopted in relation to Jerusalem with respect to achieving a two-state solution. The very act of daring to ask that question drew the usual criticism. We hadn't even made a decision. We just said, we want to take a look at this. There are some rather persuasive arguments out there. As a country, we should stop and we should look at this. And our very decision to do that was decried. It was mocked, even. including from our political opponents. Now, they either wittingly or otherwise wish to remain wedded to a status quo that is failing. They're in the leave it well alone category. Can't even tell us today whether they think we should ask the question or even the answer that we propose they can even agree with it. Well, people will know where we stand. So on the 16th of October, to answer this question, I announced a review of Australia's policy on the status of Jerusalem. I asked the department secretaries from Prime Minister and Cabinet, Foreign Affairs and Trade, Defence and Home Affairs to conduct the review. They met with a broad range of Australian community representatives, including some eminent Australian policymakers, former heads of various agencies and departments, whether in Defence or Foreign Affairs or Prime Ministers and Cabinet. They consulted Australia's partners and allies overseas, including those most closely involved in the Middle East process. I did similarly as I went through a range of bilaterals over the last month or so. The starting point for the deliberation was Australia's absolute commitment to a two-state solution. These are the guardrails, with a secure Israel and future Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security within internationally recognised borders. I also required that their deliberations respect Australia's obligations under international law and relevant UN Security Council resolutions, two things that are fundamental, I think, to Australia's interests in a rules-based order. You can't look at these things in isolation. Our foreign policy is guided by our fundamental interest in ensuring that internationally agreed rules continue to safeguard our security and prosperity. We don't get to pick and choose. In the United Nations and the G20, we have promoted the benefits of a rules-based order and in holding states to account. We have imposed sanctions on Russia in response to its violation of Ukraine's territorial sovereignty. We have called on states to comply with Security Council resolutions on a number of matters, including the downing of MH17, North Korea's weapons program, and the Syrian conflict. Accordingly, respect for UN Security Council resolutions is a relevant factor for Australia that we can't put to one side as we consider our positions on these issues. Now, Australia recognises those resolutions that apply to the Jerusalem issue, including resolutions 478 and 2334. The review team made recommendations after they completed their considerations to the National Security Committee of Cabinet earlier this week, with the resolution of the NSC then confirmed by Cabinet the following day. And since then, the government has engaged in briefings with our neighbours and counterparts to outline the position that we've arrived at. The government has resolved that Australia's position is now as follows. Australia now recognises West Jerusalem, being the seat of the Knesset and many of the institutions as a government, is the capital of Israel. West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And we look forward to moving our embassy to West Jerusalem when practical, in support of and after final status determination. We've decided to start the work, though, now to identify a suitable site for an Australian embassy in West Jerusalem. Out of respect for the clearly communicated preference of the Israeli government for countries to not establish consulates or honorary consular offices in West Jerusalem, the Australian government will establish a trade and defence office in West Jerusalem. With deepening defence industry ties and Australia-Israel trade now running at over $1.3 billion per year, this will help continue to build our strong bilateral trade relationship. Furthermore, recognising our commitment to a two-state solution, the Australian government has also resolved to acknowledge the aspirations of the Palestinian people for a future state with its capital in East Jerusalem. Australia believes this position respects both our commitment to a two-state solution and long-standing respect for relevant Security Council resolutions. It's a balanced view. It's a measured view. It's a well-considered view. It reinforces our clear view that the status of Jerusalem can only be resolved through direct negotiations between the parties consistent with those relevant Security Council resolutions. So, in conclusion, I'm about hope for better. I'm optimistic by nature and by spirit. All of our actions, from our efforts in the Pacific, and I particularly want to commend Maurice Payne and Christopher Pine for the work that has been done on our Step Up initiative in the Pacific, it has had an extraordinary response. From the Southwest Pacific nations themselves, who we just see as family, and they just see us as family. But to the broader world, everywhere from France and the United Kingdom, the United States, Japan, Germany, all very keen to work with Australia and New Zealand in terms of our leadership of that initiative in the Southwest Pacific. To our peacekeeping forces and our presidents in the Middle East, our reflections, these are reflections of our commitment to an international order that encourages freedom, peace and prosperity. Jerusalem, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Wailing Wall and the Via Dolorosa, deserves better than the rancid stalemate that we have and better than the polarisation that marks its peoples. When Anwar Sadat courageously addressed the Knesset over 40 years ago, he said, "There is no happiness to the detriment of others." Those words are still true. The Israeli and Palestinian people deserve a peace as worthy as the promise of their lands, and they deserve a lasting happiness as fellow human beings that can only spring from a shared peace. Australians have earned the right to call for such a peace and to make our contributions on how that peace can be realised and sustained, consistent with who we are and what we believe. At the end of the day, it all comes down to what you believe, what we believe in, and I think the Australian people know what I believe in. Thank you very much.
Important address. As I said, PM's got a busy day, so we're going to take a few questions and we're not going to go too long. So if you have the microphone, you've got the question. So Anne and I are here, so with microphone. So I'm just going to lead off. I mean, as you just come, Prime Minister, just coming back where you were. Mm. Okay. a lot of people watching on television. As you know, Australia is an influential nation, a middle power, and as you also know and pointed out in your speech, we've been influential in the Middle East and North Africa in the First World War and the Second World War, and in 1948, particularly under the Jubilee Labour government with the establishment of Israel. So a speech like you're giving today, I mean, to what extent do you think we can play a significant role in bringing about a two-state solution, or is it just a kind of a role on the sidelines?
Well, thank you, Jared. This is a critical question. I said in my statement that Australians have earned the right over a very long period of time to be making influential contributions in this area. As I said, to step up to the microphone. And I don't think we should be doing the microphone drop when it comes to dealing with these issues. I think those who put us in this position deserve better than that, and they deserve us to steward that responsibility about how we continue to contribute. When you look at our incredible influence, both in the creation of the State of Israel and our partnership with it over so many years, it's hard to say that Australia's influence has been small. It's been quite great, often through the great passion of the expatriate population that is here within Australia, who I think has always kept us up to the mark on these issues, as they should. So while Australia's voice and the megaphone we have is not as great as the great powers, that's true. But I've got to say, ever since I raised this issue several months ago, people have been pretty keen to know what we were going to say. And I think a world that was disinterested in Australia's view, I don't think would have responded like that. Of course. And I'll tell you why our voice matters. Because we're a successful country. We're a fair country. We're a democratic country. We've got the runs on the board about how you run an effective nation state and you look after your people with compassion and you engage with the world in an outward way. This is our form. And our form gives us great respect, as Maurice knows, better than most, on the world stage. We come from the voice of reason. We come from the voice of experience. We come from the voice of passion and commitment to the principles of peace, democracy, the inalienable rights of individual human beings. We speak for that. we've lived that as a country, and as a result, I think our voice creates holds great influence.
Stephen Hollings.
I take it, Glass.
Prime Minister, thank you very much for your speech, and thank you also for your references to the leadership role that Australia has played since 1948 and beyond in the UN. At the beginning of your speech and also at the end, you talked briefly about the Pacific. I was wondering if I could ask you more about the challenges you see to our traditional leadership role in the Pacific, given the fact that big powers now have taken such interest in countries very close to our home.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for the question. I've titled it The Pacific Step Up because that's what it is. Now, our pace of level of involvement with our overseas aid program in the Pacific has been strong over many, many years. But we, as I said, we're more than the sum of our transactions, whether that be aid or trade. There is another dimension to our relationship with the Southwest Pacific, which we are stepping up on. It's cultural, it's educational. Programs like, once again, ensuring that young people from across the Pacific will be given scholarships to come to Australian schools. That we are extending both our strategic partnerships, whether it's in defence or law enforcement, training officers, lifting standards, working alongside, continuing on the work that we've just been doing for the last few years, particularly up in PNG through their constabulary. But also the work we're doing in health, the work we're doing in cultural exchanges, whether it's on everything from football, which doesn't matter what code you follow, they'll follow it all. These are cultural connections. And our unique role here is to be the honest family member who can engage together with our other family partners in the Pacific and with how we deal with the rest of the world. There are plenty of people making offers as to how they might come and help, and they do look to us like a brother or a sister to say, well, what do you reckon? Will this be good for us? You would know. You're part of our family. And that's very much how I've communicated the nature of our role along with New Zealand, with the other world leaders. And that's well received. I mean, the great powers, they have a presence in so many places, but their size means they don't have the advantage of flexibility, which we do. And so there, through our great partnerships with them, we're able, I think, to achieve even more on behalf of our Pacific brothers and sisters. So the most exciting project in PNG, joining together with the United States, Japan and New Zealand and ourselves to take PNG from 16% electrification to 70% by 2030. That's a game changer. That changes our part of the world. Think of what that will mean in Papua New Guinea. And when I'm often asked about why we're in Papua New Guinea, I say, if you've walked the Kokoda track, you know why. And that will never change.
Final question, Catherine O'Regan.
Thanks, Jared, and thanks, Prime Minister, for coming to the Sydney Institute.
Thanks, Catherine.
Good to see you again. One of the things which I think is great is the clarification we've given in terms of Israel. But maybe you can expand a bit more on why West Jerusalem, and particularly the trade and defence presence that will be there, and how that will work towards the two-state solution.
Sure. Well, let me start with the second part first. Trade and defence, I'm particularly talking about defence industry. When I'm talking about defence, as we know, the military establishment is based in Tel Aviv, so we're not talking about a diplomatic type activity there. We're talking about a trade activity. But as we've been embarking upon what has been the biggest recapitalisation of our defence forces since the Second World War, to getting to 2% of GDP of investment in defence, and that is a well recognised achievement now. As I've moved around the various leaders in recent times, not too many people moving in that direction, and that's well respected, particularly by our allies. That trade, that defence industry capability and the partnerships we're making there, right through the supply chain, are incredibly important. So this is another great opportunity to take another step forward in that space, and our trade relationship with Israel is only building, particularly in the technology space and particularly in these sort of security type related sectors, and that obviously feeds in defence. I said there were two guardrails, if you like, for the discussion. One was a two-state solution, and that was when Dave first suggested this, about how this could be considered in the context of two-state solution. I think that was a very interesting suggestion, and I was quite taken with it. But the other premise was, as I've outlined, the importance for us to remain within the rules when it comes to Security Council resolutions. We rely on those resolutions in many other contexts, so we don't get to give ourselves a leave pass on those in how we deal with other issues. And so when it comes to West Jerusalem, and particularly the 1967 boundaries and the Green Line and so on, those issues are not in dispute in terms of where Israel is resident within those borders. Now, where those ultimately are, well, that is a matter for final status, and that will be determined. Just like where East is a matter for final status. And so we are not buying into that particular discussion. But what we are saying is we've got to move this forward. The rancid stalemate has to be broken. This is our contribution of some innovative, measured thinking about how we think this can move forward. But in part, calling it out and daring to ask the question, which others don't seem to want to ask. And in this country, those who say they support Israel didn't even want to ask the question. And even today, the Labor Party doesn't seem to be able to even embrace talking about the answer that's put forward. So people know where we stand. I think we've always been consistent on this issue. My view's the same today as it was yesterday and what it'll be tomorrow when it comes to this issue. It may not always be popular. It may cause controversy from time to time. But politics is about doing what you believe in. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. First of all, I should thank all our supporters and members for coming out at very short notice on a Saturday lunchtime shortly before Christmas. And I know there are enough questions here to go to dinner time, but PM's busy and we've got other things to do. So. And we're very grateful the Prime Minister took some questions. It was to the Sydney Institute, he gave a most important speech which will create both national, obviously, but also international interest. So a lot of people here, it's a busy day. I just want to say well done today and good luck.
Thanks, Drew. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.